it possible to carbon date this music? Let's find out where this is coming from. I'm not familiar with this.
I resent that.
Do you know what it is, Alan?
It's got to be Mamas and the Papas. No,
I don't think so. It's a fantastic sound.
Like the association.
No, it's called the Gunter Kallman Choir. That's a jazz club. But I don't know. Like, is that new? Is that retro? Is this goes back to an older time? I don't know. It sounds like the follow up to the Brady Bunch album.
Yeah, it feels like a 1960s.
You know, from that variety show.
It sounds like the dimension without the cool.
it's when Ruth Buzzy had her own show. All right. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable. Have a great. Hope you're having a great morning. We certainly are already. How could you not? And let me introduce everybody, and we'll get started. I promise you. A reminder: you can join in if you'd like to write us a letter or identify the music. We'd love to hear it. Panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, Alan. How are you, sir?
Well, we just got through doing a half an hour Capital Connection.
Yes, sir.
With Tom DiNapoli, the New York State Comptroller, who I love, by the way. He's just a great guy. You know, he and I have this sort of secret coded language that goes on between people. Does anybody remember the Jimmy Durante show?
Yeah.
In which he would say, "Good night, Mrs. Calabash,
wherever you are." Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
Well, Tom DiNapoli and I have somebody named Madame Beerbaum. Madame Beerbaum was a French teacher at Hunter College.
Yeah.
And my friend Norman Adler, later to become an extraordinarily proficient political guy, were struggling with our French class, and she had us put on a soiree for a French soiree for her, which we did with the plum. Point being that Madame Beerbaum, I told Tom DiNapoli that story as a friend of Norman Adler's, and we have talked about Madame Beerbaum in virtually every show we have ever done. So good night, Madame Beerbaum, wherever you are.
Wow, that's good. So that, and if you want the full story, you can hear that on this week's Capital Connection.
Absolutely, but only for a fleeting moment at the very end.
Oh, that's a shame. That's a shame. All right, let's go and welcome our good friend Bob Griffin. He is Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, Cybersecurity, and at the University of Albany. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Hi, Joe. Hi, everybody. I am doing well, and I apologize for last week's noise, and I think I'm in a better spot today.
not in the bathroom.
Yes, not in the bathroom. I'm moving up in the world. Just that one thing that I just want to acknowledge. Actually, it was 100 years ago today that the women's suffrage passed, and I just think we should acknowledge that advancement and also recognize how much more work we have to do. But it's a really momentous day.
Well, it certainly is, and thank you very much for mentioning it. We appreciate it. Let's go to Chris Churchill, Times Union columnist. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. Hi, everybody.
Everyone says hello.
You know, Chris,
I don't know where they are, but everyone says hello.
How did you do in French class, anyway?
We don't happen to have any women on the panel for this historic anniversary, however.
Yeah, Rich is filling in. Corporate attorney.
Wow, you just offended a lot of people really early. Jeff.
I know, but you were nice enough to take our call, and most people didn't. So, corporate attorney Rich Honan is on with us. Good morning, Rich. How are you?
I am doing well. How are you?
I'm fine. It's really nice to have you back. We always love when you're on the program. I want to also just congratulate you. From what I have been told and have learned, you were selected by your peers as the Lawyer of the Year for your work in corporate law, commercial litigation, and venture capital law. So,
yes. So
you are a Lawyer of the Year. Congratulations.
I think that's just for corporate law in Albany, so it's not, you know, globally. I'm still working on that.
No, but still a lot. I mean, it's a very high prestige thing, and I'm sure WAMC's having you on from time to time has made you even more famous.
Oh, yeah. Would you like to counter that one, Rich?
it certainly has had its effect.
We can only imagine. All right, let's get going and talk about the news of the day. There is a lot of it, so we'll get right to it. Last night, of course, was the second night of the Republican National Convention, and the main speeches, several speeches, and we can just get a quick overview of what occurred, but there were speeches by Melania Trump. There was a she spoke from the White House Rose Garden and extolled my own American dream of citizenship after a childhood under communist rule. The First Lady's speech was just one of many. There was also Mike Pompeo, who was there on an overseas trip and delivered the address with the night skyline of Jerusalem behind him. And there was a live audience for the First Lady's remarks that included the president and the vice president and a fairly large crowd in the Rose Garden. And also Eric Trump and Tiffany Trump were also part of the showcase that was put on last night. His teenage son Barron is the only Trump child not expected to speak. I think that is true. And well, let's just start with that. Alan, what do you think?
I'm reminded of Jason in the Basin. I'm so offended by this that I can't even laugh at it. There are people who are laughing at it. I mean, the idea that this guy who has made this president who has made a thing out of keeping people out of this country has his wife get up there, and don't think she wrote it, because I guarantee you she did not, and get up there and extol his position on bringing people into this country is more than I can bear. Mike Pompeo from sitting on top of the King David Hotel, where he is not supposed to be involved in politics. We know that. That's the norm. And, of course, these guys are all norm breakers. And he just addresses the Republican convention while Secretary of State, while brought there on official United States dimes. He goes ahead and he does that. And you know what? So what? He doesn't care. And that's what. He's playing to the base. They're all playing to the base. And that's what this whole convention has been like. But in the end, it's the lying. It is the lying, 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 and lying that is so offensive to me. I pass.
Chris Churchill.
Well, I thought it was a weird night of the convention, actually. I mean, I didn't think that there were I thought there were too many Trumps, to be honest about it. I mean, I don't know why every Trump child has to speak. Melania's speech didn't do much for me. I thought the first night of the convention was actually a lot better, just as television. I do think it's pretty clear that they're really so far the convention has been about base motivation instead of reaching out to skeptical voters. And, that's an interesting strategy. I'm not sure it's a good strategy, if you're a Trump supporter. The Pompeo thing was inappropriate, obviously. I mean, it's just not what the Secretary of State is supposed to do. And it was funny, too, because, I mean, they really, you would think if you're going to violate a norm, you would do it for a good reason, something that would really offer you something. But, you know, that what he said and his whole presentation was just terrible. I mean, his speech was flat. I understand that moving the embassy to Jerusalem is a big deal for a lot of Trump voters, and that, you know, that's another base mobilization type thing. But it just, like, the speech itself, you look, it had kind of a hostage video quality to it.
Rich, what do you think?
I've been watching 30 Rock on Amazon Prime.
How's that? Is that good? Yeah.
I didn't know we could do that. I thought we had to watch.
I didn't know you could take pass on it.
I'm paying all these pay services. You know, why would I watch a several-hour commercial? Look, I'm part of the base. I didn't have any interest in it. I don't know that they were pandering any more than everybody is supposed to pander during a convention.
I think that's true.
Didn't move the needle for me. And, you know, I don't know that, I don't know. I don't know if either convention, I'll defer to you folks. I don't know if either convention is going to move the needle for, the truly independent voters.
Wait. What do you mean you're part of the base? I didn't quite get that.
I'm part of the base, the Trump base, I think.
You're part of the Trump base. Okay. I didn't know that, because when you've been on in the past, then you know how we all love you. We do. We treasure you being here. And, you know, the idea that people say, well, we never have. We'd have you on every day if we could, you know. But
you're lawyer of the year, and we can't afford you.
And you're making what is it now, $1,000 an hour? But you have sometimes denied your association with Trump himself. I think. Am I wrong about that?
No, you have simply said you are not a registered Republican. Correct.
I'm not a registered Republican. I think I've always been supportive of Trump. I have not always agreed with everything I've rarely agreed with everything he said. I'm in the base, right? I'm in the group that they feel like they're going to have, they're going to have my vote. And, to Chris's point, I think whether that's going to be enough for them, statistically, it doesn't seem like it would be. It seems like you have to go beyond that base just electorally.
But you don't see yourself as a typical base, Trump baser, do you? I mean, look at your intellect. Look at how much you know. This is not who they're appealing to. I think maybe I'm just being cruel and rude.
Well, putting aside the pejorative aspect of your question.
Yes, it was. I think it was.
The question is that's the difference, right? What do you see as the base? To us, we see the base as people who are trying to be fundamentally conservative, somewhat libertarian, and other people see the base as everybody who's deplorable. So it's definitional.
Bob Griffin.
Well, I mean, I'm honored that you feel comfortable enough for it to come out on the show. So thank you for that. And as far as Chris Churchill, I mean, the good reason for Pompeo is that he keeps the pardon parachute, which apparently anyone close to the president may need in the future. As far as last night, I had a slightly different take. I actually thought that the First Lady's speech was much better than what we saw in 2016. I felt that it was one of the few real empathetic speeches that I heard last night. I will note that yesterday another 1,200 Americans died from COVID. And if you'd listened to a lot of the other speakers, including, Larry Wrong Again Kudlow, you would think that this thing is all over. There are a couple of interesting parts about her speech that I'd like to call out. One is that the quote that she made about honesty is what we deserve from a president. And I just thought that was spot on. And it's something that I think we are definitely lacking right now.
Did you think she was critical? Did you think she was being critical of her own husband by saying that?
I don't. I think there's some cognitive disconnect that what she says and she believes is and not always applied to Donald.
You don't think she wrote that speech, do you? You don't think she wrote
no.
that speech.
Well, I don't think any of the people who read any of the speeches at both conventions wrote their speeches.
Well, that doesn't, two wrongs don't make a right. Yeah.
Well, no, but you have people work on a speech, and that's what speech writers do.
But she was empathetic, and I think her fingerprints were on that speech. And I think it's interesting too is what her vision of the American dream is, which I do think is at odds with the president and Stephen Miller's position on immigration. And as I was listening to her talk about her hopes and the promise of America and everything that she wanted to grow up to be. I kept thinking, so why is it wrong for everybody else? If it was okay for you, why is it wrong for everybody else? And then I had two other thoughts. One is that, you know, when I'm starting to think about immigration and bringing skilled workers, I never thought about people in the fashion industry. So I gotta rethink, you know, what's important and what's critical. And then the final thought that I'll toss to everybody, and this did offend me, is that they had an opportunity last night to lead by example. And even if they had done something as simple as wear a mask, you know, when they had the large number of people gathered in the Rose Garden, they could have sent a clear message that they're in this pandemic with us. Instead, once again, they didn't follow even the most basic protocols, and they sent a very clear message to a lot of their supporters that this isn't important. So it's sort of a mixed bag.
How did you? Well, we're all right. I'm going to hold my question. I want to ask about the ceremony, the naturalization ceremony that took place with the president as well. We'll talk about that, and we will check in on other issues as well. We welcome your letters. Panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. Our panel this morning is Alan Chartok, Rich Honan, Bob Griffin, and Chris Churchill. And we'll talk about all kinds of things when we come back. And again, we remind you, panel@wamc.org. Don't use any other email because we won't get them that way. So use panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Next week on Love American Style.
Good grief.
good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable.
Is this a job action on the part of the control room?
I was about to say, give Mike and Sarah a raise, please. This is cruel.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. That is the program you're listening to, despite what you may think at the moment. We welcome Alan Chartok, Rich Honan, Bob Griffin, and Chris Churchill, and we have letters on the RNC, and let us go to those, and we'll continue. Derek says, I just want to congratulate Rich on his recent award and so glad that he is on this morning, adding that, yes, 30 Rock is a great show, so go Rich. Bob says, Alan is spot on. Trump is trying to relax and soothe his scared but lemming-loyal worshipers. It's going to be truly bizarre. Mark says, people react to fear, not love. They don't teach you that in Sunday school, but it's true. That is a quote from Richard Nixon. Trump is dusting off the Nixon playbook. Will it work? What does the panel think? Alan?
Well, I've been saying all along that this is going to be his play, and that's what he's going to be doing, because it's really, by the way, the only thing that is really left to them. They can't be positive. They can't take credit. They can say, well, we get credit for what we used to do and what we used to have, but we can't do it now. So we'll say we were doing great before the pandemic. But then again, will we give any credit to Obama for having been great before we were and set the whole thing up that we were living with? No, we won't do that. No. So that's who they are.
Bob?
Fear will always be the motivating force.
You know, Joe, I think I agree with what I think both Rich and Chris and Alan have said, that, you know, it is an appeal to base. I am questioning the strategy, because just looking at the numbers, you have to have more than just that base in order to win. So I'm actually skeptical that the strategy is going to win. And, you know, I'll take it a step further. I actually think Biden is going to win by a much larger margin than people think.
Yeah, no, I've said that, but I am.
That's probably where I got it then.
Yeah, it probably is. But the thing really is that he is convinced, apparently, and I've been reading a lot about this, that the base will be enough. Now, I don't see that. And so the name of the game will be get the base out, every single one of them, and make the others stay home. And when it comes to disinformation, I have some of the people we heard from yesterday. We heard from one person who said, my daughter won't vote for it because she thinks we'll bring the whole house of cards down and let Trump stay in another 4 years. That sounds like something some Russian apparatchik might have thought up when he was trying to spread this disinformation. Who knows?
Rich, I mean, you touched on that as far as going to the base.
Yeah, I agree with everybody. It sounds like when you look at the numbers, both electoral and just kind of like within, you know, the key precincts and everything, that if both bases come out, then Biden wins. I guess the only thing they might be thinking is that I assume the Trump people are hoping that the Biden base is not, the Democratic base is not going to come out as strongly, and they feel that if they can get the whole Trump base out there, that will be enough, and you know, not necessarily because of the independents, you know, which seemed to be the key last time, but. You know, the other key from last time, which is what there are 3 million less, you know, 3 million less turnout on the Democratic side and, you know, kind of strategically placed. Maybe that's what they're thinking. They're thinking that the Democratic base is not as coalesced as they want it to be.
Do you think that the Hillary candidacy, Rich, and the Biden candidacy are equivalent?
Again, I'm on the outside looking in. I feel like Biden Harris is a stronger two things. One, it's a stronger ticket than, you know, Hillary and what's his name.
Tim Kaine. But go ahead.
No, I knew that.
I know you knew it. I just, for our listeners, but go ahead.
Right.
Yeah, but you know, and the you know the Harris thing is interesting and could really incentivize the base. But I think the other thing is, I have to believe there's a feeling among the Democrats that they just got caught napping last time, and that's not going to happen again. Almost like a football team that's looking forward to, you know, the following Sunday and then gets beat by a weaker team because they just weren't concentrating. I feel like that's probably the bigger thought, and they're going to make as sure as they can that doesn't happen again. And they are going to push and get out, you know, go to all those states and, you know, the Pennsylvanias and, you know, and
Michigan,
really get out there.
Do you, are you both Alan and Bob has said that they see, you know, kind of a runaway. How do you see it?
Me?
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, Joe, I was surprised that Trump won last time, you know, right?
Right.
And everybody except Alan was. It's so hard because the flat numbers, you know, you look at the Hillary numbers and, you know, I think what she had 3 million more votes overall. But then you look at New York and California together, and those two together gave her a 6 million plurality. You know what I mean? So it seems to me that the answer is so marbled throughout these really specific identifiable districts, you know, within states. I see it being difficult. I could see it either way. I could see it being a close election. I could see it being a landslide just because it sounds like a few 100,000 or 200,000 people spread throughout the electorate can have a really, really big effect.
Chris.
Well, I think it's going to be a pretty close election. I mean, the polls show a pretty good Biden lead at the moment, but I definitely think those are going to tighten. It's just the way that the country is, it's a very divided and pretty much evenly divided country. And I do think Trump's base is big enough to win if they push turnout levels to kind of, you know, enormously high rates. I saw one thing that said, you know, they were at 60% of his base voted last time. If they could get that up to 70, 75%, they could win. Not a popular vote, win necessarily, but they could win in the Electoral College. And going back to the original, question, fear is a motivating factor. I think some of the attacks on Biden, and I think this is one of the reasons that Biden is probably a stronger candidate than Hillary was. I mean, they're clearly having a tough time knowing how to go after Biden. And I think some of the things they're saying just sound so ridiculous to people that I just don't think that they'll work. You know, the whole Biden wants to abolish the suburbs, or Biden is a socialist, or it doesn't square with what anybody knows about Joe Biden. It doesn't really square with Joe Biden's record, which is actually pretty business friendly. But I do think the Democrats do have something to worry about. I do think the violence in the cities is a vulnerability that they need to address. And I think Joe Biden needs to say something about it. I mean, people, it does seem to be rising. If you look at when people rate which issue is important to them, violence in cities seems to be rising. And in one poll I saw, it was equal to the coronavirus and people's concerns.
Yeah.
And I do think that Democrats had better address it. They didn't mention it at all during their convention. And they didn't mention the economy much during their convention either, which I thought was just a completely blown opportunity. I mean, I think they should have been hammering how they're going to fix this economy, and they didn't do that.
Bob?
How would you handle...
Oh, go ahead. Rich, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I don't want to go out of order.
Go ahead.
No, because Chris, I thought Chris brings up an interesting point, and I'd ask, the rest of you, how would you handle the kind of civic unrest issue from the Democratic side, where you want to, obviously, you need to be sympathetic to the underlying causes of the unrest, which hopefully everybody is, but you also need to take some kind of stand on, violence as a response to, a social situation. Am I overplaying that? Is that a difficult tightrope for the Democrats? How do they do that?
No, I think you're spot on, Rich. And the first way I would do it was I would call attention to the fact that there has been so much disparity, and we have worked so many issues into the very systems of government that this is an outcome of the frustration of people who feel like the government and society is not serving them. I think Biden has taken position against the violence, and at the same time supporting Americans' right to peaceful, free speech and disagreement. I would imagine, that if I was advising the Biden campaign, I would be advising them that this is a great opportunity to rethink the roles of Department of Education, Department of Housing, Health and Human Services, and to say, listen, we have to start to address these issues, because while there may be an urban issue today, it's an American issue. And when you start to get into the key issues of poverty and food insecurity, and how hard it is just to raise your kids today, that resonates across all aspects of American life.
And what I think is that Trump ought to, I think that Biden, I'll be quick about this, but Biden ought to come out forcefully. I mean, forcefully, not just say something, but forcefully say this is wrong. There should not be burning. There should not be looting. I'm opposed to this. And I think because there was a point in the, there is a point that you really have to just tell the truth. And it is not satisfactory for Americans to be seeing this kind of stuff going on. I'm sorry. There'll be some people who say, okay, it's absolutely all right because they're frustrated. People are frustrated. But, you got to say this is wrong.
Alan, I think he's getting internal pushback. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Chris.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, there have been Democratic mayors who have spoken very forcefully against the violence. Keisha Lance Bottoms in Atlanta was terrific when it came to her city. But there have been mayors in places like Portland and Minneapolis and Seattle who have not been forceful enough. And some of that violence, I mean, some of this, like what we're seeing in Kenosha right now is clearly an outgrowth of what happened over the weekend. And in a way that's more understandable than what and what's been going on over in recent months. I mean, I have a tough time tying some of the violence in Portland and Seattle to George Floyd. I think it's kind of taken on a life of its own. And I think that Democrats can kind of thread that needle where they're saying, you know, we understand why people are upset. When we agree with you, the systems need to change. On the other hand, we can't have what we've been seeing in Portland and Seattle and some other cities. You know, and the other thing too, when I said violence, I don't just mean the kind of the social unrest. I also mean this kind of the homicide rates, which are spiking out of control in a lot of cities, including in Albany.
Right.
And there's a lot of disagreement about why exactly that's happening. But I do think that it needs to be part of Biden's campaign. And I know it's a tricky issue for him because, you know, some of his anti-crime stuff in the past is now viewed as pretty racist and pretty over the top. But I think he needs to find a way to do it.
But well, think about it.
Trump is going to hammer that home.
Yeah, but think about it. Trump is the president. I think you make a very good point, Chris. At least that's what I think I heard you say. You know, Trump is the president of the United States in these very violent times. Blame it on him. If you're the Democrats, say he's the president.
That's a good point. I mean, Nixon ran as a Law and Order candidate, but he wasn't the president at the time, right? It is more difficult to say that, you know, you're going to be the guy who calms the chaos if you're currently the president while the chaos is happening. And I mean, and that is, you know, maybe that's the opening for Biden. You know, I'll be the one who brings calm and order to the streets and kind of takes the temperature down a few notches.
Go ahead, Rich.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Well,
go. I'm okay.
We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're just late for a break. So when we come back, we'll continue on this, and we'll talk about this. And also like to talk a little bit more in detail about what is happening in Kenosha. Two killed, one injured last night. And so we want to talk about that as well. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Let's get to those letters before the top of the
before
hour.
Before you do that, Joe, I just yes. need to make this comment that, you know, I'm expecting to hear, yeah, Mr. Griffin, you're up next for your root canal. So thank you. Thank you for this music.
it is very Mitch Miller.
Yeah. Well, you can... It was for you, Rich. Sing along with Mitch and Rich. All right. Let's go to the letters. We go to Kate, who says, the comment about how many Trumps are speaking is interesting. It reminds me of an Instagram meme I saw that said something to the effect of, when 6 of the 12 speakers of the RNC share the president's name, we might be wandering into North Korean territory. Anne says, how can Rich or anyone with kids or not support a president who will undo every regulation that will help protect the planet from effects of climate change in the future? From allowing drilling on sacred Native American property in Alaska and other sensitive areas, support of coal burning and fracking, etc., our planet will not survive the effects of another 4 years of Trump. Would you like to respond to that? Rich?
Yeah, that's interesting because my political drivers and one of my drivers in voting for Trump this time is exactly because of my kids. My son will be hopefully graduating in 2 years from Buffalo, and I want him to be graduating into a good economy and a place where he can get a job. And a place where he can, you know, somewhere where he can live safely. And those are the kind of things I'm looking at. Obviously, I know the listeners look at it. The listeners agree. They just think it's a different person who can deliver that. But no, that's actually one of the drivers for my thinking as well.
Well, wait. What about the ice caps melting, the seas rising, the pollution? Alerts around the world. What about your kids and their kids in that context?
Well, just to be clear, you know, the conservatives are against the ice caps rising too. Just so we're clear, we want that to be addressed just as well. We just would like it to be addressed a little more efficiently than I think the last deal, the one that Trump pulled out of, where I think China would still be 10 years away from having to do any kind of compliance with that deal. That's important. It's all important. But I'll tell you, Alan, and maybe it's just, you know, my inability to get a grasp of a situation of that magnitude. At the moment, I'm worried about an economy for my kids to be able to work and a place for them to be safe. That's what I'm worried about.
And of course, I just would be remiss not to mention all the crap we're putting into the air that is causing the ice packs to melt, right? I mean, in other words, look, you're right. This is short-term versus long-term, but long-term, this is horrible.
Agreed. And I think all of us, I know you don't agree with this or believe this, but all of us want to see, you know, a clean and safe, you know, Earth. You know, we get that, conservative as well as liberal. You know, I'd like to see, yes, I think the United States, by the way, is making some gains there, especially you see the proliferation. That word. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You know, not only of electric vehicles. And remember, Alan, too, look, I'm in the venture capital business. Somebody wants to come up with really workable, clean energy, we're all about that. You'll make a fortune. People are working on it. People are trying to make fuel cells work, and people are trying to make solar walls work, and people are trying to, you know, use wind and everything. It's just storing and delivering that energy is very, very difficult. But we want that to happen just as much as you do, whether it's for money reasons or whether it's for the good of the earth.
Well, Obama comes up with a whole bunch of fixes, one of which is, you know, let's make the automobile companies make sure that they're putting less garbage into the air. And you're Mr. Venture Capital. What do you think about that? You know, the fact that the automobile companies are going to really have to strain, and now Trump comes along and says, I want to put a stop to that.
Well, I don't know. Since Trump's been president, I think Tesla's stock has gone from, you know, $190 to close to $2,000. Tesla's starting to own the world. Everybody else over the last few years has been rolling out some version of electric vehicles. I think the range of them is now getting up to, what, 400 miles. And again, whether the driver is you want a cleaner planet or the driver is you want more money, I don't care so long as we get to the right end result.
All right, let's go to more letters. Mike says, hello, panel. I'm interested in Rich's opinion. Did he agree that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will turn America into a socialist utopia, as Senator Tim Scott promised at the Republican convention? Can he speak to proof of this from this Democratic ticket's lifelong actions?
You know, one of the reasons, Joe, seriously, that I'm not on that much is I always feel like everybody directs the questions to me and it's unfair to the rest of the panel. So I want the rest of the panel to, no, really, and I'm putting aside the hate mail. I'm just like, I always feel like everybody's, you know, they're like, you know, you have the chance to ask the conservative something.
I'll take it then.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, that's what I said earlier. It's ludicrous. People are not going to believe that. I mean, if there's a legit criticism of the Biden-Harris ticket, it's that they're too friendly to Wall Street and too friendly to big tech. I mean, there are Republicans who are criticizing this ticket from the left economically. And I think Trump would actually, in some ways, be better off doing that. It doesn't, the argument that these two are socialists is just bizarre. And, you know, there are elements in the Democratic Party that are pushing for a more socialist direction. That's undeniable. But I think it's very hard to tie Biden to that, I think.
Well,
go ahead, Rich.
And Rich, I think it's... Rich, sorry.
Go ahead, Rich.
No, go ahead.
I'll go.
No, go ahead.
Okay, Rich, I think it's really important that you do answer the questions, because what you're doing is that you're showing a lot of listeners that there is more commonality than we have led to believe in the last 3 years. And it's this type of discussion that becomes a question about how to implement policy, not about whether the policy is valid. So you just said, yeah, you know, everybody wants a safer, cleaner world. I actually appreciate your insights, because we can't as a nation just become echo chambers. And that's what I fear. And I fear it even more because it means that the two parties aren't compromising, that there is no push to compromise. And our whole system of government is predicated on the idea that compromise is what makes the country go. And when we're in these times when we don't want to talk to each other, then we're in very, very, very dangerous waters.
That's nicey-nicey. But do you really think that Trump... That's nicey-nicey.
But do you really...
Kumbaya this, idiot.
I didn't say that. You used the I word. But do you really think that Trump wants a cleaner world, or that he gives a damn at all by revising all of these provisions in our laws and the things that have been put in place to make sure that we're going to be safer and cleaner? Do you really think that?
I think that labeling everybody that supports Trump as being that same ignorant is not fair. And we have a tendency to do that. It becomes a very black and white situation where if you're a Trump supporter, I can't listen to you. I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to hear from you. So that's what I was trying to address. Do I think that he believes? No, I don't.
Rich?
By the way, just one last thing. The Times has a terrific story this morning in which they interview a number of people who are Trump supporters and find out what their motivation is. And this is in reaction to everybody saying, how the hell could anybody vote for this guy?
Look, to answer the original question, no, I do not think, I don't think Biden's a socialist, and I don't think Harris is a socialist, okay? And I think that, you know, that was some hyperbole, which I guess you expect. But no, I don't think that. I do think two things that I think the Trump campaign is going to try and get across. One of them is this whole idea of Biden and Harris being, quote, moderate. I think they're going to keep hammering away at the fact that it's moderate on the left wing of the spectrum. Okay, and so that it's not we don't necessarily see them as moderate, the way I might think of someone as a moderate. With to call somebody a moderate Democrat still means that they're pretty far left, in our opinion. The bigger issue, though, when you get the socialism question, the civil unrest question, I think what the point that the Trump campaign is trying to get across, and that a lot of his base, me included, are concerned about, is it's not so much Biden and it's not so much Harris, okay? But it's all the people who are going to be pushing them. It's that if you vote for them, you're voting for the Lori Lightfoots, and you're voting for the mayor of Portland, and you're voting for the city council of Seattle. And obviously I'm speaking expansively here, but you know what I mean? And you're voting for Gavin Newsom, and you're voting for Beto O'Rourke, and you're voting for a wing of the party that is, in our opinion, out of step with the traditional Democratic Party, let alone out of step with most of America, yet seems to have a strange hold on the direction of the party. So while I don't think that Biden or Harris, are going to come out and advocate socialism, I don't have a lot of faith that they will have the ability to fend off the very powerful forces within their party who do want to move us in that direction.
And
I
think example.
Well, we're really late for break.
When we come back, can you give us an example of what these freighters are?
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, Rich Honan, Bob Griffin, and Chris Churchill on the panel this morning. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Well, we'll just take a break and calm down and listen to Ray Graff give us the news, and we'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, 9 minutes past 10 o'clock. On the panel this morning, we have Alan Chartok, Rich Honan, Bob Griffin, and Chris Churchill. And I think right before we were going to a break, we were talking to Rich. Alan asked Rich a question of asking if he could give an example. And Rich, have you thought about the answer to that question?
Sure. I've been doing nothing but thinking about that while dancing along to
whatever this is. Yes.
Yeah, I'm doing like a modified, just for those of you who want to know what dance I'm doing at home, it's kind of like a modified kind of swim kind of thing. You know, like the old, remember the swim? Nobody? The twist?
Yeah.
Because that just goes along with music. Well, I don't know, Alan, you could start, I guess, with, raising taxes on everybody over 400,000, raising taxes on corporations. You could talk about free college tuition for everybody. What's the number now? Everybody making under 125 grand a year. He picked up the Warren Sanders proposal of let's forgive student debt. Which, by the way, I just don't know where that goes with all of the students who actually have been diligently paying off their debt, and now we're going to pick that up. What was it, $1.7 trillion in new green jobs that, you know, he's going to take away the coal mining job, but he's going to teach you how to put up a windmill. I think these are all very progressive policies. I think they're all pushed by the Sanders-Warren wing, and the best example of that to me is, you know, if Joe Biden, you know, thought any of this was important, he didn't say it over the last 40 years. You know, I know people need to say things to get elected, but to me, that is a very definite and a very specific shift to the left. And that's the kind of thing that makes us worried.
You know, Rich, you were talking about, you know, it's not particularly the candidates themselves, but the people behind the candidates. It has been pointed out to me by somebody far smarter than I am that Trump has a few friends, too, you know, who are the rich in this country and the wealthy and the people who really want to do the exploiting. So, you know, you can point and say, well, they're, you know, these, the Democrats have some socialist friends. But what about the, for want of a better word, the pigs? Who want to get all the money?
Yeah, agreed. Sam Fear.
Well, Biden has those friends too, Alan, which is the problem of painting him as a socialist. Yeah.
All
right. Let's go back to letters if we can. We go to Dale, who said, I don't understand why activists have chosen the phrase defund the police as a rallying cry. It implies the complete elimination of police funding, while most people using the phrase actually are only asking that some of the funding for police be redirected to other agencies or programs. I doubt that the far right media will do anything to help their listeners make this distinction. Bob, would you like to take that one?
Yeah, I'm in complete agreement with the letter writer. I actually despise the phrase because I think it diminishes what the movement really is about, which is rethinking policing and community policing and how we provide services in our communities. So I think, as I said, the letter writer is spot on. They're not trying to get rid of police departments. They're trying to make them work more efficiently. And honestly, Joe, we've asked the police to do things that are not, that have not traditionally been in their areas of expertise, including social work and social welfare and mental health provision and aid. And I think we really need to rethink what their roles are.
So, you know, and we've done the same thing. For some reason, I think of the police and the teachers a lot together. One, because, you know, they both do really important jobs, and two, when one of them does not do their job, it kind of has a disproportionate impact because of the amount of responsibility we give them. But I think both police and educators are put in this position where we're asking them to do so many things in addition to, you know, what they thought their job was supposed to be. And all the things you just listed, you could say the same for, you know, a high school teacher as well, right? I mean, they're babysitters, they're social workers. We're just asking a lot of people, and then we're putting I think we're putting a lot of stress on them when they are, you know, unable to perform.
Yeah, absolutely, Rich. And to take that a step further, it's you know, we've hidden, I think, the true effect of a lot of the changes in funding that happens at the local level, even though it may start at the federal level. I mean, if you start to think about the real pullback from the federal government of putting money back into state and local governments, and what happens is that's felt most significantly at the street level. And I'm going to take your point to give an example of how I think we could rethink policing is that so many times it's not an issue of law enforcement. It's an issue of mediation. It's an issue of having a counselor who can come in and de-escalate situations. And to me, this is, I think, one of the most important things we can start to do is try to de-escalate rather than escalate. And if you start to look at the situation that occurred over the weekend, that was a significant escalation. And that's a pattern that we're starting to see too much of.
Let's go to other letters. Jesse says, the reason that everyone wants to ask Rich questions is that it's so rare in most of our daily lives to find a conservative who will answer thoughtfully and honestly. I wish there were more guests like Rich on the roundtable, despite being a left of the left liberal. Shows with Rich on them are my absolute favorite and the ones where I actually learn the most. We go to Nicole, who says Trump pulled out of the Paris Agreement and left it up to the states to do their own thing regarding climate change, just like he did with COVID. When Trump pulls out of something like Obamacare, his consistency is that he never has anything to replace it with. Do all Republicans want to throw out the baby with the bathwater? Scott says, my college-age children have decided not to have children because of climate change. I believe we have a mandate as adults to do our best to secure the future of our planet. The human race will not survive if Trump is elected again. This affects the future of my children more than the economy. The Umbrella Man in Minneapolis writes, Catherine, an early rioter, looter, has been identified as a white supremacist. The right benefits more from the violence than the left. I'm not saying all the violence is being caused by people on the right, but I wouldn't be surprised that a good amount of the violence is being started by right-wing agitators. Brenda says, I don't understand.
I mean, that doesn't matter.
Joe, before you go on, go ahead, Chris.
What's that? I'm just saying, that almost doesn't matter. I mean, it's Democrats who are in charge of the city. You know, the point is, it's not necessarily who's to blame for the violence. It's who's responsible for not stopping it, right? And I think that falls on some Democratic mayors and Democratic governors.
So just to be clear,
I don't necessarily agree with that, Chris.
Do you think Mayor Sheehan is responsible for not clearing things up in Albany?
Well, I was talking in particular about looters and rioters and the kind of stuff we're seeing in Portland and in Seattle.
Yeah, but you said the
in terms
Democrats.
Of the violent crime rise.
But you did say.
Well, I'm not talking about the Democrats in those cities. No, I don't think she. It's a tough question because what's happening in Albany
That's
is happening
why I
in cities all around the country. Yeah, including in some cities that are led by Republican mayors too. Right, so it's not. It's a little bit simplistic to just. I mean, it's people are having a tough time trying to explain why this is happening. And if you can't explain why it's happening, it makes it very difficult to stop. But, you know, going back to the defund the police question, I mean, to say defund the police right now is to be just completely out of touch with reality. I mean, if you go into neighborhoods where this crime explosion is happening, people are asking for more police on the streets. You know, they do not want the police defunded. And the reality is, if we want good police departments, the police departments that I think people on the left and the right both want, we're probably going to have to spend a lot more on them. We're going to have to train the officers better. We're going to have to make sure they're not working extensive overtime, you know, and getting stressed out. And then we're going to, you know, they're going to need training and de-escalation and all these sorts of things, all of which take more money, not less money. Defund the police is just, to me, just a completely bizarre rallying cry.
So it's not defund the police. It's reform, but seriously reform the police.
Okay, so then say reform the police.
Well, I'll tell you what I mean by that. When I see cops shooting a guy in the back seven times who's getting into a car, that's a moment when you say reform the police and do it fast.
Right, I mean, let me just add. Yeah,
but to prevent those things from.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
But to prevent those things from happening, we need better police departments. We need officers who are trained better. We probably need a higher quality of officer, and all of those things take more money, not less money. I mean, shifting some funding to social services or taking some responsibilities off of out of the police hands makes some sense, but you know, defund the police is just to me, that's an activist thing. That's something that activists say. I don't hear many ordinary people agreeing with that.
No, that's right. That's right. That's correct. You don't hear many people. So why do you go back to it as being a point of departure, since it's pretty well been, you know, if not discredited, but left aside?
Why do I go back to it?
Yeah, because you keep saying, well, that this is absurd to defund the police. Okay, let's give you that. It's absurd. It's not going to happen. It's past the spying. But we certainly do need to reform the way we supervise our police, and we certainly have to find out who we're recruiting to our police departments. Because I'd like to know a little bit. Yes.
And those things take more money, not less, right?
Yeah, you need more money. You may need more money to do that. I agree. But it isn't the matter of defunding the police.
Yeah. Well, Alan, wait. One thing that doesn't cost any money would be reinforcing attitudes. And I don't know if this is going to come across, as, you know, old line thinking or whatever it is. But, you know, part of this also is the attitudes that people have when they are being given instructions by the police, you know, rightly or wrongly. You know, this idea that, you know, when the police tell you to do something, and, you know, and yes, look, I grew up in a, you know, in a white middle class, you know, lower middle class household, and we were always told, you know, when the police do something, you listen. And I understand it's very different in other types of households where the police are not always as benign. But at some point, part of this solution has also got to be that when the police say stop and put your hands up, for example, that shouldn't be an option. And that also increases the situation. You can de-escalate the situation by reinforcing some of those attitudes as well. And I don't think that's a proposition.
A lot of people will argue with this because they'll say, well, being black while breathing is a reason for a cop to stop you and say, put your hands up. That could get pretty wearing after a while. Or if you don't put your hands up, you're going to get shot in the back seven times. Rich, that doesn't make an awful lot of sense to me.
No, Alan, look, I agree. There's no question that, you know, Rich Honan driving a car is going to get stopped either not at all or a lot less than, you know, young African-American man driving a car or walking down the street. And there's nothing right about that. And that's a huge injustice. And that's something that we need to continue working on. And I don't even know how much progress we're making on that.
What do you mean working on? The fact of the matter is we worked on it. And all of a sudden we have Black Lives Matter. We have people in the streets. I've never condoned, by the way, violence, and I still don't. But I have to say, there comes a point at which you just have to say enough already. You can't do this anymore.
Well,
I mean,
Alan, see, that's where we depart, because the minute you say, I'm against violence, but, or I'm against rioting, but, or I'm against, you know, attacking the police, but I understand why. The minute you say that, you have blurred the line between, you know, violent and nonviolent. And at some point, you have to decide whether you're going to say, no matter how bad the social provocation, okay, that responding in some kind of physical way is going to put you down a path that is never going to go to a good place. But the exact thing you just said is the exact thing I hear from a lot of Democratic leaders, where they say, hey, you know, the violence and the riots are really bad, but I understand. I think you got to stop.
You got to stop and say, stop the violence. Let us work on these underlying issues.
Yeah, but this, we're not talking violence here. We're talking about a guy who was trying to get back in his car with his three kids sitting in the back and was shot 7 times in the back. Come on, Rich. That's not what your mother would have wanted you to be to learn.
I also probably wouldn't have struggled with the police the way I understand. And I don't know the story, and I'm not going to get into the facts because I know there's – but, you know
– 7 times?
I thought that there was actually a physical struggle that went on before that. I don't know. And I'm not – I'll defer to everybody else on the facts.
He was trying to get in a car. So you're telling me if he gets in a car, you shoot him 7 times in the back, even if he's trying to get away? Come on, there's got to be better ways to do that.
I think there are, and that's my point.
And you know, it's also interesting to me, though, that, you know, and I think this is part of the hypocrisy that maybe you know I feel, and I think others feel about this current administration, is the sense that laws don't apply. So they only apply to us, or they only apply to black men that are on the street. But, you know, I'll just give you an example. I just came across the ticker that, 14 minutes ago, Mark Meadows, who is the chief of staff for the president, says that he dismissed the issue of Hatch Act violations as nobody outside the Beltway really cares. It doesn't matter. It's a law. And you can't selectively choose which laws you're going to follow. And what infuriates me is that this administration consistently violates the law, and they are not held accountable. Now, I'm not trying to equate that to the rioting in the streets, but there is a sense right now that there are multiple different laws in this country, and they apply very, very differently depending on who you are, what color you are, how much money you have, and that's not what this country is built on.
I absolutely agree, and I feel the exact same. I absolutely agree. I think that's the argument I make every day. Obviously, I'm usually flipping that argument, saying, you know, why is it that I am expected to obey every law, and I see other people out there and seem to be getting a pass. And I agree with you, whether it's the administration or whether it's the people, you know, torching cities in the name of social unrest. And we know those are not the people who are really trying to affect, you know, the right social change. I feel the exact same thing, and I feel it with the exact same amount intolerance that you feel it with. Mm-hmm. Fully agree.
Anything you'd like to add, Chris Churchill?
No.
You're a wise man, Mr. Churchill. Let me go to just a few more letters before we go over to a break. Trump pulled out of the Paris Agreement and left it up to the states to do their own thing regarding climate change, just like he did with COVID. When Trump pulls out of something like Obamacare, his consistency is that he never has anything to replace it with. Do all Republicans want to throw out the baby? I apologize. Thanks.
All right,
Rich.
Good. Either that or
it's just sometimes they sound alike, don't they, Rich?
It was worth reading it a second time.
But Joe, before you move on, though, I just need to note that at the same time, though, he ordered and his administration then blocked California from carrying out the type of
exactly of
environmental reforms that he granted to them because he said it wasn't the role of the federal government. And again, you can't have it both ways. If you're going to talk about state rights, then you need to allow the people in the states the freedom and responsibility and authority to do that. And that is the true hypocrisy.
We go to Chris. It is Brenda, who says, I don't understand why POTUS isn't being held responsible for any violence on his watch. Why does Biden have to assume responsibility? Which I think we touched on.
We did, and I certainly seconded that. Yeah. You know, this is his watch.
Tom says the American people understand that it's not just one or the other. Biden can say to be shot in the back is not right, to be suffocated by a cop kneeling on you is not right, but it's not right to smash windows, loot businesses, and terrorize neighborhoods. Both have to stop. In my administration, we will address both, because both need to be addressed. We go to...
Wait, who's administration?
I haven't heard him say that yet.
I think it's Tom. Tom's administration.
Oh, I get it. Okay.
I'm voting for Tom.
Jeff says violence is in the violence in the cities is an issue, but it's happening under Trump. Show the chaos in the streets, the awful death rates of the pandemic, and make it clear that this is the situation under Trump. Democrats will have an entirely different approach and will stop the chaos in the streets by engaging with protesters, by providing appropriate investigations, by mandating public health measures. How can the current situation be used by Republicans to condemn Democrats? It's happening under their watch.
Good letter.
We go to...
Right.
I'm sorry? You were agreeing?
No, I was agreeing with that. Yeah, I mean, that's what I said earlier. It's very hard for Trump to run as a law and order candidate when he's the guy in charge, ultimately in charge.
Let's go to, I only have like 5 seconds here. So we will take a break. We'll go over, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with our panel, Alan Chartok, Rich Honan, Bob Griffin, and Chris Churchill. We will do so right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the last go-round here on the Roundtable panel. We have Alan Chartok, Rich Honan, Chris Churchill, and Bob Griffin. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's move on to other subjects, shall we? We go to the airline job cuts. This is an interesting story. Airline job cuts could pressure Congress and Trump on stimulus. American Airlines said it would furlough 19,000 workers if lawmakers do not extend aid to the industry, which has been hammered by the pandemic. American Airlines warned employees on Tuesday that it would cut up to 19,000 workers on October 1st, saying that there was little sign that the pandemic-induced reluctance to travel was diminishing. The airline is looking to cut thousands of flight attendants, pilots, technicians, gate agents, and other staff. It said, including buyouts, retirements, and leaves of absences, the company expects to have about 40,000 fewer employees on October 1st than it did before the pandemic, a 30% decline in its workforce. American is just the latest airline to predict bad news. Earlier this summer, United Airlines said that it could furlough as many as 36,000 employees, and on Monday, Delta Airlines warned that it may have to furlough as many as 1,900 pilots in October, even after nearly as many had accepted buyouts. So the question is, what will actually be done on this? Well, weak demand is spurring these announcements. The airlines are also seeking to put pressure on Congress and the Trump administration to strike a deal on another coronavirus stimulus package. Passenger airlines received $25 billion to help pay workers under a March legislative package, with American alone receiving $5.8 billion. Alan, we'll start with you, and then we'll move around the group.
I don't know what there is to say except that the rich get richer. There's an awful lot of power there. When a union does something like this, they're accused of blackmail. You do this, we're going to strike. But when a company says, either you give us the money or we're done, and we'll start firing workers all over the place, it's quite reprehensible. And it occurs to me that somebody must be talking to other people, because all of a sudden these things don't just happen at once among competitors. Rich?
I feel you, dog. I agree.
Oh, darn.
Bob?
I'm sorry. I'm still getting over calling Alan dog. I think that was brilliant. and you also need to add Delta to that mix as well.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, Delta dog. Yeah, Delta Dawn. I mean, surprised we haven't played that today. I'm really worried about the economy. I think there's an awful lot of lagging indicators that haven't caught up. And even I'm thinking about what's occurring in academia right now. And what worries me about what United and Delta and American are saying is I start to think about all the secondary and tertiary jobs that go along with the airline industry. So you think about everybody who's working in the food service industry, think about baggage claim, you start to think about parking attendants, start to think about hotels. I am in agreement with American and United that there needs to be another stimulus package. I also feel really strongly that state and local governments have to be included in that, because the type of pressure that is occurring is going to have catastrophic impacts on the basic services that we've been talking about, things like police and education. And this is a role where we need federal leadership. It needs to come from the president. It needs to come from the speaker. It needs to come from the president pro tem of the Senate. But I'm very worried about where the economy is heading.
Chris?
Well, I said once on this program that if we were serious about climate change, we would stop propping up the airline industry. And when I said it, I got about three or four emails from listeners who just thought it was the greatest thing they'd ever heard. I do think there's some truth to that, right? You can't have it both ways. You can't say that climate change is this existential crisis and then continually prop up an industry that is one of the main contributors to that crisis. That said, I mean, obviously you're talking about thousands and thousands of people who will lose their jobs, and obviously don't want that to happen. And I don't, you know, I agree with Bob that the economic ramifications of this are severe and that a lot of people are going to be hurt. And that's why, you know, I would have argued if I had been in charge of the Democratic convention and also the Republican one to a lesser degree, I would have focused much, much more on economics and on pocketbook issues than they did. There was a lot of, you know, kind of identity politics and a lot of bashing of Trump in that convention, but I would have been all economics all the time. And I think the Republicans are doing a little bit better job of that. But they're also kind of, I think both conventions to me seem like they're almost happening in this like alternate world where there isn't this massive crisis happening out there that's affecting millions and millions and millions and millions of people.
Yeah, let me also say I agree with that. I agree with everything that's been said. And I think that, you know, certainly what Bob says, like I think next year is going to be a grim year. I also think that the effect of this is just so stratifying, where you're really, even more than whatever income inequality you had before, you're going to have, you know, what the Wall Street Journal calls like the pajama generation, the people who can work in their pajamas, you know, the people who can work from home, versus kind of everybody else. And you're just going to see a real increased stratification between those groups. The other thing I will say, and this is probably an anti-conservative thing to say because it's kind of a European idea, and it's kind of the underpinning of the Paycheck Protection Program, this idea that instead of the government giving support, but instead of the government giving support directly to people, government giving support to the industries like the airlines, and I agree they shouldn't be bailed out, but if the support comes from the government through the industries, it keeps those people more engaged in that job. It keeps them somehow connected. And rather than paying somebody unemployment, maybe another strategy is to pay their employer and have their employer pay them, and you preserve that connection. I can see that. I understand that's a completely socialist idea, but that is the only thing I would say in favor of the idea of, you know, the giving the airlines or any other industry direct money, because I think you maintain that connectivity that's going to be important.
Yeah, and you know, Rich, I think you're spot on, but I think that money needs to be absolutely dedicated to payroll, and it can't be siphoned off for CEO salaries. It can't be siphoned off for stakeholder profits. And it's one of the reasons that I think some of the European economies, and I'm thinking France and Germany in particular, are are stronger right now than I think our economy is because they did this. And I agree with you. If we're going to pay people, you know, to be, you know, because they're out of a job, let's keep them in the job and let's keep money in the system. Because that money is, you know, those dollars that are going to those 40,000 employees makes its way into so many different areas of our economy. But I don't agree with the bailout, and I think it has to be more heavily policed than the last package.
Yeah, I agree with that. I will say that is one thing for all the what's called obloquy that the PPP got. I think that it by the time it was done, it was pretty clear that money, and I think everybody who was a recipient of that money made very sure that money was going to go basically to employees, you know, to employees and, you know, whatever, you know, the care and feeding, you know, like everything you needed to keep them, but not to things like dividends and not to, you know, executive salaries and things. So I think by the time that program finally came to its final iteration, I think that there were some pretty good controls over that. So, yeah, I agree with you.
All right, let's go to one other thing here. We have a couple of letters that I would like to get to. Chris says, today's debate on police, street violence, and presidential campaign plans platforms danced over fear and law and order. Never once today has any panelist said the word racism. Is everyone unwilling to lay bare the elephant in our room? Racism, say its name. It's what's for breakfast, lunch, and dinner until we face it.
Couldn't agree more. I've been saying it all along.
Yeah. But I do believe that we've been talking about it. When we're talking about inequalities that are baked into our systems, when we're talking about the differences in systems and laws just because you are black or brown, that is racism. I mean, so I would push back gently on the writer and say that the issues of racism, addressing racism, have been interwoven into so much of this conversation today. But if it takes just saying racism is a huge issue, I'll say it right now: racism is a huge issue, and it's something that we have to take seriously, and we have to make some true change and progress, not just lip service as we have in the past.
Trudaine says, I'm black, and a cop friend once said to me that one of the issues around policing is that they are taught to win an encounter. The idea that if a person doesn't comply with the police's with a police officer's request shouldn't justify the type of violence they do to citizens. The umbrella of threat is way too large. Noncompliance isn't a reason to kill. Many police kill because they feel disrespected, not because they are protecting. That from Trudaine. We go to Eric, who says violence is never an appropriate response to social injustice, including the murder of citizens. Does this mean that no war is ever justified? We are.
But before you go, sorry. One last sentence, though. I got to give a shout out to every police officer who's on the street, though. It is such a hard job, and we as a society and people have made it even more complicated. And I think sometimes we lose sight of you know, both how many great people are police officers, but also the fear their families live in every time they go out on a shift about whether their loved one's going to come home. So you know, there are absolute reforms that have to be made. You've heard me say it, but at the same time, I think we need to make sure that we're supporting the public servants who are out there trying to do the job.
I know, Bob, in the 1 minute that we have left in the program, you did want to leave on a high note, which is the WHO declaring Africa polio-free.
Absolutely. And for everybody at home, it's like, oh, my God, I'm so depressed by this panel once again. You know, there is just such amazing news coming out of Africa today that they are polio free. What an amazing accomplishment. What an amazing accomplishment for the will of people to make change, for the power of science, for our ability to work together as human beings. I mean, this is a story that should lift everybody, and it's just not getting the amount of play it deserves. And people like Bill and Melinda Gates and Jack Dangerman and Esri and corporations who have put their heart and soul and money quietly into making this happen deserve and a huge bow. But this is just super, super important and wonderful news in times that sometimes we just don't get good news. So thank you for the opportunity, Joe.
Well, thank you. Alan, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks to Rich Honan. Always good to have you on the show, Rich. I appreciate you being here. And Chris, thank you very much. We will be back with the Congressional Corner right after this.